Let's get together, talk about the movies that we saw this week. We'll have discussions, talk film news, we'll laugh a lot and act like geeks. Sometimes we'll have a guest or two, sometimes it's just the two of us. Let's crack some jokes and tell some folks to come along and hang with us!
Mike and Mike go to the movies. Mike and Mike go to the movies. Yeah!
You have chosen wisely.
All right, hello and welcome to the podcast that hurts like hell when you step on it, Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a man who believes that everything is awesome and that everything is cool when you're part of a team.
Mike Tricia.
And isn't this a great team to be a part of, Mike?
It really is. You know, couldn't think of a better team. Well, I think there's one addition that could be better, Mike.
You're right, actually. We could add something to the team. Also joining us this time around is a guy that we've mentioned on the podcast many times in the past, actually, our old college buddy, E.J. Carella. Welcome to Film Bookcast.
Thank you so much for having me be a part of this, guys.
Of course. Yeah, we're excited to have you.
That's such an underwhelming, thank you, but yes, thank you.
No. Go on. Grovel. No.
Yeah, just, keep going. Just thank. We can make this an entire podcast of just thanking us, and I think that'd be fine.
That'd be great.
That's all right. I can do that.
That's what the listeners want.
So credit for all of our theme songs goes to Kyle Cullen. If you want to contact us, you can send us an email at mikeandmikegotothemovies@gmail.com. Don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes or Apple Podcasts if you can, since it helps people find the show and makes us feel good about ourselves when we get good reviews. Now, if you've ever listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news and then move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. Today, of course, EJ will be joining us. And then after that, we move on to our featured review. And today, that's going to be the second Phil Lord Chris Miller animated movie we've gotten in the last 2 months, the Lego Movie 2, the second part. And I was pretty excited about this. EJ, I wanted to have you on the podcast because you are a huge fan of the Lego Movie.
I am. I was such a big fan of the first one that it got me fired from FYE 6 years ago or 7 years ago.
Right. Do you want to tell that story or should we keep that under wraps?
Are you legally allowed to divulge?
I just thought it was something funny to say. No, there's actually really no entertaining story there. We'll just leave it at that was a younger me in a different time. I'm no longer giving, I can tell this to all my current employers, I'm no longer giving illegal discounts on products to my friends.
Wow, I forgot that's what happened. Now I got it. Nailed it.
Yes, but the reason EJ partook in such criminal activities is because he loved the Lego Movie so much and he wanted everybody to get a chance to experience the Lego Movie. Is that right, EJ?
I will not refute that.
You're just too generous was the problem.
Yes.
Exactly. You were too giving. You were like Robin Hood, but for Legos.
My legal counsel has just let me know that to remind everybody at home that those are your guys' words and not mine.
All right. Fair enough. I mean, you're the one who brought it up. But
Roger Stone all of a sudden.
We are talking Lego Movie 2 today, and we're going to do that in a little bit. But right now, let's get into some film news. All right, it's time to get into some film news here on Film Bookcast, and we begin with the passing of a couple of major character actors. First off, Albert Finney passed away this past week, of course, from Big Fish and Miller's Crossing. I think a lot of people would know him as Daddy Warbucks from Annie. He was somebody who was transformative and kind of a legend in the acting community. And I think his last movie role was Skyfall, actually. So
he's the caretaker, right?
Yeah, that's the role that it seemed like they were trying to get Sean Connery to come back for, but then he didn't, and then Albert Finney kind of took his place. And yeah, I think he's a great addition to that movie, and he's just great in everything. There was somebody tweeted out a lot of stuff from Miller's Crossing came out on my Twitter feed because it was a Coen Brothers movie that he was in, and it's a great performance from him. And somebody tweeted out that he loved making the movie so much. There's actually footage of him as an extra in the movie after his character died. dressed up as dressed just in the background of a scene.
That's awesome.
It's kind of amazing. So wanted to say RIP Albert Finney, and also RIP Dick Miller. Guys, this really upset me. And I don't know if you have as big of an emotional attachment to Dick Miller as I do, but he is a character actor who is a staple of Joe Dante movies in particular. He's in every single movie that Joe Dante directed: Gremlins, The Howling, Innerspace, Explorers, all that stuff.
Gremlins. You got to watch out for the foreigners because they plant gremlins in their machinery. That's the same gremlins brought down our planes in the big one.
Big one.
That's right. World War II. Good old WWII. You know, they're still shipping them over here. They put them in the cars, they put them in the TV, they put them in the stereos and the radios. You stick in your ears, they put them in your watches. They got little teeny gremlins for the watches.
I don't think it's such a good idea that you drive. Why don't you walk home?
You know, Katie, I think maybe I'll walk home.
Good.
That's a nice night.
And of course, he was a huge Roger Corman asset as well. That's where he and Joe Dante first met. I think he has like 190 credits to his name. he's one of those guys who he would pop up in a movie and I would just like smile, like I would just be happy that Dick Miller was there, you know.
Stay tuned for Complete Work season 2. Another 10 years of our lives
where we watch 190 Dick Miller movies. I would be down. I mean, it'd be weird because usually he's only in a movie for like 2 to 3 minutes at a time. But he was a legend among character actors. I mean, I remember a few years ago I got Pulp Fiction on Blu-ray, and I watched the special features and the deleted scenes, and all of them had an intro from Quentin Tarantino. And so he was describing the deleted scenes, and he was saying that he actually got Dick Miller to be in a scene of Pulp Fiction that he ultimately had to cut, but he was so excited to just have him in the movie. And so he's actually, the deleted scene with Dick Miller in Pulp Fiction is on the Blu-ray, and it's really great.
One of the things to note him here is the guy playing Monster Joe is Dick Miller, who's one of my favorite character actors. If you're a Joe Dante fan, he's in every Joe Dante movie, and was in 72 Roger Corman movies, and it was just an honor to put him and Harvey Keitel in the same frame. So anyway, here it is. It's the Monster Joe and Raquel scene.
I said it before, I'll say it again. Your business is always welcome.
I think by now I've earned the equivalent of frequent flyer miles.
Frequent flyer. Tell you what. If you ever need it, I'll dispose of a body part for free.
How about an upgrade? You dispose the whole body for the price of a body part.
Was that no-frills body disposal? I can take out on that in the yellow pages. No, I got to run out past my accountant.
Where's that reprobate daughter of yours?
She's on the yard up to no good.
And yeah, he's just in so much different things, especially Roger Corman Productions, Rock and Roll High School, Chopping Mall, all that stuff. He was one of the best. He's just a great presence in every movie that he was in. So yeah, R.I.P. Albert Finney, R.I.P. Dick Miller. Just wanted to get those out of the way before we get into some actual film news. And Mike, we mourned the loss of Filmstruck so hard a few months ago, right?
Yes, we did.
Yeah. EJ, did you ever subscribe to Filmstruck, or was that out of your price range? Fair enough. Not to throw you under the bus, but
but in all honesty, I did use Filmstruck briefly. Clearly not as much as you guys did. I mourn along with you guys. All right, I hope that I can, because those are the kinds of film sites that we need more of, I think, personally, just with the content that it had. But this is also a stark reminder to everybody that obviously digital copies of things and things you can get on streaming sites, they're not going to last forever.
Yeah.
And there's always going to be opportunities. There's always going to be, what I like to call a bad actor, but it's just somebody out there that, one financial decision here or there, and anything could disappear, you know. There's no reason to believe that even like a site like Netflix is going to last forever. And
yeah.
That's a pretty powerful question to think that's going to, that will keep me up at night, that has kept me up at night. You know, how am I going to get Stranger Things when Netflix goes bankrupt in 2066?
Spent many sleepless nights wondering how you're going to get your 11 fix.
Yeah. These are the hard-hitting questions.
Dark thoughts.
Yes. Dark thoughts, indeed. Anyway, a silver lining of news, and in any case. Obviously, Filmstruck is no more, but one of the big things about Filmstruck was the Criterion Channel that was part of it. And now Criterion Channel has announced they're going to be launching their own streaming service, and it's going to kick off in April. Now, Mike, you were the subscriber to Filmstruck out of the three of us.
Yes.
I pawned off your account like a leech, you've been getting emails about the Criterion Channel. What do you think about all this?
Yeah, it seems pretty neat that the Criterion Channel, you know, that was obviously, like you said, a huge draw for Filmstruck, is going to launch their own thing. And right now you could sign up early and lock in a lifetime lower rate, which is pretty cool. I appreciate that they're doing that, because they – heard, you know, obviously heard the outcry of a thousand voices sudden or millions of voices suddenly silenced, crying out for help about Filmstruck. Right. So you can sign up early and lock in like a lifetime of I think it's like $10 less or whatever it would be. If you sign up after it launches. So that's pretty cool. We're kind of mulling that over, thinking about it. And they have talked about continuing. One of the major things we talked about with Filmstruck, about why we loved it, was how curated it is, or was. And it's so hard to talk about that, because when I hear, like, curated content, I think, like, the shitty YouTube algorithm, and, like, everything is Nazis for some reason. But that's not what this is. They would organize things, you know, they would do special themes, you know, highlight directors and put all their movies in one collection that you could go to, or you know, westerns or whatever, and it'd be like, or western starring this one guy, and it would be like this whole thing, and, you know, they would do all these awesome curation things, putting content together in ways that were creative and unique and stuff you probably hadn't thought of before. And they talked about wanting to continue that on the Criterion Channel's streaming service. The only thing, my only hesitation, is it's not going to include Turner Classic Movies or the Warner Archive, which was another huge draw for Filmstruck. So I don't know. We're kind of torn on this, because Criterion is amazing, but it's a fraction of the content.
Right. So it's going to be like roughly the same price as Filmstruck was, but for a lot less content than Filmstruck had, which is kind of a bummer. But they, like, theoretically, this thing has room to grow. Like, it could end up getting the Warner Archive later on or something.
Yeah.
Although Warner, I think, is trying to launch their own streaming service, so we'll see what happens with that. I don't know. That's the problem, is everybody wants their own streaming service, and I'm not sure if the market can.
Well, you know what's going to happen is there's going to be 50 streaming services. Somebody's going to come together and bundle them all for one low price with ads, and we'll be back at cable.
Disney will just acquire them all.
Which, hey, you know, then they'll all be in one spot, so.
It would be bad, but also convenient.
But also convenient. Thanks, late-stage capitalism. I'm giving a thumbs up to the viewers at home.
Right. A sarcastic thumbs up.
Yes.
Towards capitalism. Anyway. So, yeah, that's the Criterion Channel stuff. And then I wanted to get into some actual movie news here. Obviously, I'm curious, were you guys fans of World War Z? EJ, I feel like you were, right? Did you like World War Z?
I actually was. There were a few elements I liked. This obviously wasn't, like, even for the genre of zombie movies, this obviously isn't, like, a top five or even a top 10 installment. But I think there were, if you're a fan of the genre of zombie movies, I think there was definitely something that it offered. Instead of, I'm not just talking about Brad Pitt, but I mean, I did enjoy it, and I think I don't know. I always thought the concept of those kinds of zombies, not from like a disease, but like fast moving running zombies, has always been something of interest to me. Not so much in terms of like realism, but I would say more just along the lines of it done in the right circumstances. I feel like it can be a little refreshing. And that's kind of what I gather in the first movie. I'm kind of scared of that question, too, because I feel like for the audience that doesn't know who I am, and now they hear me talking positive things about World War Z, I feel like they might just end up muting my my turn of the podcast.
No, I don't think that'll be the case. honestly, like, World War Z is a movie I did not like that much when I saw it in theaters, and I haven't seen it since it was in theaters. But I don't know, like, something about it has, like, I feel like it's crazy, like, what stays with you over the years, you know? And with World War Z especially, there's that one sequence with, like, the zombies that kind of turn into, like, a weird tsunami, like a, you know what I mean? Like a giant mountain of zombies. And that imagery is great, and it has stuck with me since that movie came out. And it's imagery that is ripped off in other stuff. Remember Fate of the Furious, where they did the zombie cars? It was the exact same thing, but with cars.
Oh, my God.
That's true, yeah.
Anyway, this is all a way of saying that, you know, World War Z was a pretty big hit when it came out. Not so much critically. It got okay reviews, but financially it did pretty well. And they've been trying to get a sequel off the ground for a really long time, like, since the movie came out, but it just has never come together. And a few years ago, Brad Pitt approached David Fincher, of all people, to direct a World War sequel, if you will. And
is this all a long setup just to make that joke?
Yes, it is.
And it has to be the title now, if they ever do make it.
Right. And that's the thing. So David Fincher got attached to make the World War sequel. And, you know, that was one of the things where it's like, I was not that interested in a sequel to World War Z. But if you get David Fincher on board, like, hell yeah, I want to see that movie. And so it's been like 3 years since he was officially announced as director. And now word has come out that David Fincher's World War sequel has sadly been canceled.
So tragic.
That's a bummer. Apparently Brad Pitt's actually really pissed at the studio because the studio was just like never pulling the trigger on this thing. So it doesn't sound like it was David Fincher's fault. It doesn't sound like it was Brad Pitt's fault. It sounded like it was a studio just like who didn't really know how to market a World War Z 2, which is weird because World War Z was a big hit and you have, you're basing it on a book that was pretty popular when it came out.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting. It seems like this is like such a passion project for Brad Pitt. Because didn't he also produce the first one, right, if I remember correctly?
I believe he did, yeah. I mean, he started it, and I believe he was also a producer on it, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I remember, like, the one thing, you know, you talked about that, like, imagery of the, you know, the tidal wave of zombies, which is definitely great. One of the things that sticks out about World War Z to me is, like, its production trouble. I remember reading a lot about how they had to reshoot the whole last third of the movie, and they changed it, and they cut it, and... Like
yeah,
all
they
this
on
stuff.
They had to bring in like three different writers to try to fix the ending. I think one of them, I think Damon Lindelof was one of them.
Yeah, I think so.
And I feel like Drew Goddard might have been another one too. Like, there was a lot of people who ended up on the writing team of World War Z.
Yeah, so I'm not surprised that it is still also having production troubles, and I guess it's not going to happen now. So who knows?
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. I'm kind of, part of me is like a little upset because like it was a new David Fincher movie that I got excited about, and he hasn't come out with a new movie since Gone Girl in 2014. He hasn't worked on Mindhunter, so there is that. Yeah, so hopefully this frees him up for other projects. Apparently, like I think David Fincher kind of knew this wasn't going to be happening for a while because he's set to work on Mindhunter season 2 anyway. Like,
yeah,
you know what I mean.
He's got stuff to do. He's fine.
Yeah, so yeah, I think his attitude was more like, yeah, if this comes together, I'll get around to it, but like I'm working on this right now. But hopefully this frees him up to do something more interesting.
I would be more excited, on a side note, to see a more geopolitical field kind of zombie movie that I think is the thing that Brad Pitt was attracted to the most, given what he and Angelina Jolie have been so active with in the world. I think that is an interesting aspect of it that I think, you know, in the right hands, there could be something interesting about that.
Yeah.
Because you talk about the giant tidal wave of zombies, and I'm thinking more about, you know, the scenes where Brad Pitt was in Israel, and how they were talking about the wall, and how they were trying to keep even humans, more humans out.
Right.
And those are the kind of the parts that stuck with me the most, was more like the behind the scenes, more like how governments are going to react to a zombie outbreak and how they're going to try to suppress their own people instead of really trying to head on tackle this zombie epidemic that's kind of affecting everybody. But at the same time, I wouldn't be so sure that World War Z is completely canned. I can totally see a zombie movie coming out of just canceled zombie movies of the past.
What if
kind
it's
of a mashup idea?
The canceled zombie Avengers, is that the idea?
That's kind of the angle I'm going at.
They pull a zombie split, and it's a secret World War Z sequel.
Ooh, yeah, like some
exactly.
Random movie.
Yes.
Just suddenly, like Zombieland 2 turns out to be a World War Z
Whoa.
Sequel.
Whoa! Yeah, that one's for free, Mr. Eisenberg.
Because Jesse Eisenberg is the creative force behind Zombieland 2, of course.
Well, he's got that Zuckerberg money, you know?
You know he's not actually Mark Zuckerberg.
You know, I've heard it both ways.
Fair enough. All right, so let's move on from the World War Z news and get into some DC news, where Jesse Eisenberg played Lex Luthor, so maybe you're right.
See?
Anyway, so DC, always throwing stuff at the wall, hoping something sticks, and got a few additional tidbits here for their superhero movies. Obviously, Aquaman, huge hit for DC, and I didn't see that coming. Like, you didn't see that coming, Mike. EJ, did you see Aquaman?
I did see Aquaman, and I did not see this kind of popularity, this kind of fuzz for it at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it did pretty well in the U.S., and worldwide it made over $1 billion. It's DC's biggest movie ever. Like, it made more money than Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
It made more money than The Dark Knight. This thing has been huge, which I, you know, quite frankly, I was not the biggest fan of Aquaman. But, you know, it does have its pleasures, I guess. But anyway, obviously they want to try to capitalize on the success of Aquaman. And they're currently working on a sequel. They want to make an Aquaman 2 happen. But now they're also developing an Aquaman spinoff about the Trench, which are these weird, like, demon fish creatures that are in, like, one scene of the movie. I saw this article, and I did not know what they were talking about.
And you saw the movie.
And I saw the movie, like, a month and a half ago. Like, I should remember. But that movie is just, like, one long, colorful blur. to me. So, EJ, do you know what the trench are? Like, do you remember what the trench were?
I don't remember specifically exactly the purpose that the trench pretty much had in this kind of world for this movie.
Yeah.
I do remember, though, I remember reading a lot into... there have been a lot of references and allusions to H.P. Lovecraft in this Aquaman movie, and I've been reading a lot of articles about it and stuff. I've heard people talk about the trench, mainly specifically from one particular H.P. Lovecraft short story. That name is not coming to me right now. The book's literally like 30 feet away from me, but I'm afraid to run over there and then spend like 15 minutes going through the pages.
Right.
listen to you turning pages.
We do this in real time, so you're right.
Exactly. I think it was The Shadow Over Innsmouth. I think that's the name that's coming to my head.
Okay.
But, yeah, so my takeaway from this is why can't we just have H.P. Lovecraft horror movies and maybe even a universe involving those creatures? it does seem a little out of place for a movie studio, especially a movie studio that's doing DC movies and has so many DC properties they could handle, try to pick a really obscure aspect of a film and try to...
Yeah.
DC is trying to make, obviously, as much money as they possibly can. So it's just weird because they have so many properties... Obviously, with the movie studios that they can totally explore. There's certainly a lot they could explore with Aquaman, but so it's just really weird that they're gonna pick this aspect of this movie and run with it like they are.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, one critic I follow, Scott Mendelson over at Forbes, did point out, Aquaman was directed by James Wan, who also directed the Conjuring movies, and this is sort of how the Conjuring universe got started, too. You know, you had the main movie, The Conjuring, and then you had, you liked that one weird monster that was in one scene? Here's Annabelle. You like that one weird monster that was in one scene of Conjuring 2? Here's The Nun. Like, that's how the Conjuring movie built out their universe. So maybe there could be, like, an Aquaman sub-universe within the DC extended universe. Like, who knows what could happen there?
I mean, that's sort of an interesting way to think about it because, you know, Marvel, it's very different, but Marvel has its TV universe, which is a sub-universe of the movies.
Sure, yeah.
So it's definitely possible to have these kind of little smaller stories that are unrelated to this overarching stuff. But put this up there with Sony's Black Cat Silver Sable movie. Like, it'll never happen. Come on.
Like, hey, you never know, man. Venom opened a lot of doors for Sony, man.
That's true. And Birds of Prey is actually happening, it seems like.
Birds of Prey is actually happening. That's a DC thing. But yeah. Morbius, the Living Vampire, has a release date now. Like, it's...
What?
It's coming out... It's set for 2020, man. Like,
right after Shrek 5.
Right after Shrek 5. Anyway, so yeah, that's the trench news. And then some other DC stuff. This is stuff that we basically knew was already happening, but it's now official. First off, Ben Affleck is officially not going to be in Matt Reeves' The Batman movie, which is now aiming for a 2021 release. Now, I mean, Ben Affleck, I was never the biggest fan of him as Batman. I think this is probably a good idea, you know, start fresh with a new Batman, if you have to make another Batman movie, which you really don't at this point, at least for a while. But Matt Reeves is a good director, and I think he'll do a good job casting the new Batman, whoever that ends up being. Do you guys have any, like, casting choices that you would want to see as Batman?
Not...
So many.
I mean, it's such a weird, like... I would appreciate something, like... weird and bold, like,
right.
I don't know. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head, but something different instead of like a 40-year-old jacked white guy.
Well, I remember the rumor a while back was Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
And I think he would do a good job, but I think that ship has kind of sailed because he's now Mysterio in the Spider-Man movie that's coming
out
in 2019. So who knows what's going on with that? I don't know. I could see, like Keanu Reeves. Or something.
Just give me John Wick Batman.
Just give me John Wick Batman. That's all I ask for. All technically,
oh my
I guess.
God.
I think Ben Affleck's Batman kind of is John Wick Batman in certain scenes.
You're not wrong.
In terms of his massive fetish for violence and killing people. Which,
yeah, just
exactly
like Batman.
Not exactly what you want for Batman. But yeah, so we'll see what happens with that. As far as Ben Affleck goes, you know, I think he wasn't really given the chance to be a great Batman because he was failed by the movies he was in. I think it's a good idea to kind of go in clean slate at this point. And then finally, one last bit of DC news here, and this is stuff that, again, we already knew, but is official now. James Gunn is officially writing and directing Suicide Squad 2, which is now called The Suicide Squad, which won't be confusing at all, and is also set for a 2021 release. Now, are you guys on board with the James Gunn Suicide Squad movie, especially after the whole debacle with the Guardians movies?
Maybe out of pettiness to Disney. Am I interested? I mean, it's definitely going to be a much fresher take than what the first Suicide Squad was. I feel like we can at least make that level of assertion, but I don't really know. There's definitely a lot of complicated feelings because Guardians of the Galaxy, at least for me, is one of the Marvel properties that has really hit home the hardest for me personally. At the same time, I think I'm a big fan of that group of superheroes more than some of the other groups of superheroes Marvel's had. And so I don't know. There's definitely a lot more feelings attached to this new story than even I anticipated.
I think that since Suicide Squad is a ripoff of Guardians, Gunn could have a lot of fun doing a Guardians ripoff, satirizing Guardians.
Yeah, his own thing. That could be a lot of fun. And apparently it's going to be like a kind of soft reboot of Suicide Squad too. He's changing up the cast a lot, I think. Like, he's getting rid of most of the characters in the first movie. And kind of just doing his own thing with this, which is, again, probably for the best.
Yeah.
And I would imagine if you're going to keep any, it would probably be Margot Robbie and Will Smith. But Margot Robbie is making that Birds of Prey movie, so who knows if she'll be in this Suicide Squad movie. And I think Will Smith could be, like, a decent anchor for this movie if that comes to pass. By the way, this is completely unrelated. Did you see the picture of Will Smith as the genie in the live-action lab?
Man, what a shame. You know, I had a lot of faith or a lot of hope for that movie because it's Guy Ritchie, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Doing, like, urban street kid crime stuff. And I was like, yeah, this is going to be great.
And maybe. Instead, you're getting the Brazzers porn parody of...
maybe not. Latin.
Yeah, I don't know. It looks... we'll withhold judgment until we see it, I guess. But, like, oof.
He looks like David Cross as Tobias Fünke.
Yeah, it's exactly what it looks like. And it's a shame. But I was actually, like visually... I was upset about it. Like, and
yeah, it's some Uncanny Valley shit. It's gross.
Yeah, it's really, really weird.
Yeah,
there's not really much else to add. This just looks bad.
There's nothing else to add.
Anyway, so Suicide Squad 2 is happening. James Gunn is making it. And that wraps up our film news for today, guys. So let's move on into our discussions starting right now.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions here in Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you got for discussions today?
I have just a few things to discuss this week. First off, I watched the first pilot episode of Bodyguard. And this is one of those good BBC Netflix joints, which I am very, very fond of. And this stars Richard Madden, who some of you listeners probably remember as Robb Stark.
From Game of Thrones.
On Game of Thrones, yeah.
Yes.
That actor. And this is, I feel like I've been making this comparison a lot, either like on the show or just like in life lately, and telling people about stuff that is the blank version of 24. I feel like that came up recently somewhere. But this is British 24, basically. the Kiefer Sutherland show.
Yes, I'm familiar.
But this, yeah, you might have heard of it. And this is a story is about this guy who's a police officer, I think, or an MI5 agent or whatever. I don't remember exactly. Like, the Department of Homeland Security equivalent. Mm. The first episode kicks off with him thwarting, this attempted terrorist attack just by chance. Like, it's insane.
Yeah.
I think it might only be, like, 15 or 20-minute sequence, but it feels like a 10-year-long sequence. It's, holding my breath, like... Oh my God, I can't believe this is happening, like insane. And it's really great. So he gets promoted and assigned to be the personal bodyguard of one of heads of parliament, like one of the top ministers or something like that. And the show kind of kicks off from there. So I've only seen the first episode so far. I think it's only 6 episodes in the season. One of them, like I said, them good BBC joints. So I look forward to checking out the rest. My parents watched it and they were like, holy shit, you gotta, like, they were freaking out.
Yeah.
They told me to check it out. So I like where it's going. I think it's going to be... It seems to be handling a lot more, you know, stuff than 24 ever could have dreamed of being, like, handling gracefully.
Yeah.
You know, that was such a dumb, stupid network action show.
Sure.
And this is, you know, Richard Madden's character is Afghan war or Iraq veteran, and the minister he's assigned to voted to send troops, and it's, like, dealing with PTSD and that kind of butting heads stuff. So, yeah, it seems like it's going to be good, also with a lot of, like, high-tension drama. So
yeah.
That's Bodyguard. It's available on Netflix right now. I think season two, this season aired this past summer.
Okay.
In 2018.
Yeah, I feel like this was a big thing at the Golden Globes this year. I think they was nominated for a few. I remember Richard Madden being there anyway, and I'm pretty sure he won something. So it was probably for this.
We can only assume. So check that out if you're interested. And then the other thing I want to talk about is Bo Burnham's Eighth Grade.
When did you get Snapchat? What grade?
Fifth grade?
Wait,
so were kids, like, sending each other, like, nudes in, like, fifth grade?
No,
like,
okay, that is a weird question.
What does that
that's,
like,
no,
a weird question.
That is
a weird question. I don't think
she's seeing dicks in fifth grade. Just, like, she's, like, wired differently.
She's not wired different.
I'm not saying it's, like, a bad thing. I'm just making a, like...
Let's stop this now.
Jesus Christ, fine. I'm just, like, making a fun point.
Okay, fun point made. Let's go. Okay?
Don't bring me into this shit.
I actually like the filters on Snapchat and stuff. Those are cool. Yeah, me too.
All right. Now, this was my number three movie of the year, if you go back to our top 10 episode.
Yes. I finally got around to seeing it. I had intended to see it before the top 10 episode, but in my marathon of watching movies, I missed it.
Yeah.
Even though I think it was available to stream on Amazon for free with Prime the whole time, which is how I saw it.
Yeah.
And this is, like you said when you talked about it, it's a coming-of-age story for the, you know, post-millennial slash internet generation. And just, damn, son. I wasn't, like, it's Bo Burnham. Like, it's going to be, like, jolly fun times, right? Is what I thought.
I mean, and you say that, but, like, the last several stand-up specials that he's had are not... They're not what I would call, like, jolly fun times.
That's fair. Yeah, they're kind of like jolly dark times.
Yeah.
And that's really what this movie is. It is some of the most uncomfortable, awkward situations I've seen in a movie in a long time. And I feel like that people like that should be a warning for people. If you can't handle secondhand embarrassment,
right?
Like you don't like if you can't watch The Office because you're too embarrassed for Michael Scott, which I know some people that are like that can't handle that kind of thing. Like, well, just don't. Don't try with 8th grade.
Don't even come near 8th grade. Don't even scroll past it on Amazon.
Don't watch the trailer. Just keep going. But if you can handle that thing, secondhand embarrassment, this is a powerful, very powerful movie. It deals with stuff very bluntly. And at the same time has that satire, hard satire that Bo Burnham... only he can manage to do as someone that grew up like in this generation, became famous because of YouTube and his songs and his comedy and his puns and all this stuff. I feel like this is a movie that only someone like him, well, I guess really only he could have made. You know, I went back and watched some of his old like stand-up specials and like his old original YouTube videos and stuff like before watching this. And there, like there's one Welcome to YouTube, one song.
Yeah, I remember.
Where he performed, which is like a takedown of YouTube, which he performed at like YouTube Celebration at YouTube headquarters in front of a live audience with Katy Perry on his piano.
There, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, what the f- like, I can't believe, and he's like 18 or whatever he is in that video. Like, it's insane.
Hey, welcome to YouTube. I said to listen and linger. Charlie the Unicorn bit my finger. It's YouTube. The impact is evident. Miss Teen South Carolina just ran for vice president. Upload a video. You got nothing to lose except all of your friends and the approval of your parents.
So it's someone that like has the sensibility to do stuff like that, taking down the internet generation, but in a way that maybe not even taking it down, sort of just analyzing it and kind of breaking down, dealing with it. You know, we've talked about Vice and all these other movies lately that kind of like, well, it's the young people's fault. And it's like, fuck you, man. I was 10 when this shit happened.
Right.
You know, and Bo Burnham kind of breaks it down that like maybe it's not the 10-year-old's fault that the shit is happening.
Yeah.
you know, from the teachers dabbing in the middle of class, which is like hilarious. But like no one's even looking at him, and he does it. Yes. And it's like, oh my
such
god,
a note perfect. Like it's like you could see that happening in your junior high school. You know,
yeah, yeah. There's one moment in particular that I lost my shit at, and was like, it's the most Bo Burnham thing. You know, a lot of his stand-up specials are filled with, like, fake improv. Like,
yeah.
You know, moments that, like, oh, somebody made a mistake, but actually it's all part of the show kind of thing.
Yep.
And there's one, the moment when Kayla?
Kayla, yeah, I think so.
Kayla, yeah, played by Elsie Fisher, who's outstanding in this movie, goes to, a girl's pool party, right? And she puts on her bathing suit, and she's standing at the back door, and like we have this really intense music and slow motion close-ups of all these kids, you know, yeah. People that she's deathly afraid of, and she finally works up the courage, and she opens the door, and it gets jammed, and like, she can't fit through the thing. Like, that is the funniest fucking shit, and it's Bo Burnham to a T.
Yeah.
So I can't recommend 8th grade enough if you are the kind of person that can withstand secondhand embarrassment. Because that's the whole movie. It's 90 minutes of feeling bad and embarrassed about Taylor. Yeah.
Or having PTSD flashbacks about your own embarrassment in 8th grade, which...
yeah. Like you said, I remember you told the story. Your friend you were with was, like, crying. And he was like, this has all happened to me or whatever. I don't remember exactly.
Yeah.
And mixed in with all that is really heartfelt, powerful performances from, her father. I don't remember the actor's name. Who is playing that, like, really dorky, like, dumb character dad who just wants his daughter to think he's cool, but is also, like, deeply emotional and connected and loves his daughter, and it's very powerful. It ends on, like, a nice high note, I think, but definitely check it out.
Yeah, that is 8th grade. It's on Amazon Prime right now, and yeah, it's fantastic. It was my number 3 movie of the year. You had a lot to say about 8th grade, Mike. Usually these discussions, like, all right, I watched this Netflix thing. Let's move on.
I got something. Let's just get out of here. But I feel like, you know, like, you even mentioned it. Sorry to come back to it. In your thing, your number 3 when you talked about it in the top 10, that's the sentence I was trying to say. that even if you are not in 8th grade, like, you know, we are 10 years older than the characters in this movie.
Yeah.
Or maybe 50, I don't know, whatever, however old you are, and 15 years older.
We are eons older than the characters in 8th grade.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's still entirely relatable if you're not part of this, like, internet post-millennial generation.
Yeah.
It is very much about those things, but entirely universal at the same time, which is impressive. For Bo first movie. Like, that's insane.
It's absolutely insane. Yeah, EJ, you saw 8th grade too, right?
I did. I believe it was number 5 on my top 20 movies list of the year.
Okay, nice. Yeah, so all big fans of 8th grade here on the podcast. So, yeah, go watch it. It's fantastic. And then I've got a few things I wanted to discuss here in discussions here. The first is the new documentary from Peter Jackson called They Shall Not Grow Old.
I was 16 years old, and my father allowed me to go.
I was just turned 17 at the time.
I was 16.
I was 15 years.
When they came to us, they were frightened children and had to be made into soldiers.
Well, boys, here he comes. We're in the pictures.
I gave every part of my youth to do a job.
I'm so jealous you got to see this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still in theaters right now, actually, so you could theoretically go see it, but if you want to.
I think
to.
There's a Fathom event or, like, one of those things coming up.
Oh, really? I mean, it was playing, like, for real. I saw it in, like, 3D IMAX the theater near me. And this is a new World War I documentary from Peter Jackson, the guy behind Lord of the Rings and King Kong and all that stuff, made entirely out of old stock footage from World War I. That has just been beautifully restored in a way that hasn't really been done before. Like, there's been, like, the History Channel things, like the World War II in color and that kind
of
thing.
In HD.
Yeah, exactly. And they're, like, colorized footage from World War II, but not to this extent. I mean, A, World War I film footage versus World War II film footage is very different. Because World War I was happening between 1914 and 1918, which is, like, basically, like, right after film was invented. And so if you look at that old stock footage, it's all silent. You know, it's all silent film because sound hadn't been invented yet. It's all black and white because color hadn't been invented yet. And, you know, a lot of it's, like, in fast motion because that's at that point in time, like, you know, the way you worked the camera was you cranked it, and whatever the speed was that the guy was cranking the camera, that's how fast the picture was going to be. And so basically what they've done is they've taken all this old stock footage from World War I, this silent, soundless 60 millimeter film, and transformed it into this incredible, like stunning, like visceral color film with full attention paid to sound and character and detail. The movie is narrated by these, you know, archival interviews from World War One veterans that the BBC has like on stop, like on standby. Like basically,
wow.
the movie begins before the movie even starts. Peter Jackson actually like introduces the movie and says like I was approached to do this like 4 years ago. It took them 4 years to make this documentary, and he said you know apparently Peter Jackson's a huge World War One buff. His grandfather fought in the war, and that really becomes clear later how big into World War One Peter Jackson is. But when he introduces the movie, he's like, yeah, so the World War One Museum in Germany. Or Britain or whatever, they approached me about making this movie, and they said, we have all this old stock footage, and we want to make a documentary out of it, but we want to do it in a very unique way. And so he kind of came to the conclusion of, like, well, what if we could take this footage and make it big and expansive and something that feels modern? And they've succeeded. I mean, it took them years to do this, but it's incredible to watch. And even better, after the credits, there's, like, a 20 to 30-minute documentary about the making of this movie. And how they actually transform that footage. And it's fascinating. It's so cool. And that's when you really see that Peter Jackson's like a huge, like he's, like there's one point where he's like, yeah, so we're looking through this frame and like you have to see like the colors on all these different uniforms. And like there's so many different variations of colors and you got to be right on each one. So I went through my closet of World War One uniforms, you know, like people have.
Wow.
And it was great. And so a lot of it, it's just, you know, Peter Jackson, like, in the back studios in New Zealand, like, just kind of colorizing this footage and adding so much different sound effects and different things and, like, adding the music. It's really, really cool. Like, the documentary about the making of this movie is, like, almost as good as the movie itself. So it's awesome. I highly recommend They Should Not Rule. I think it's an awesome documentary. And I'm pretty excited about that. I'm just excited that I like a Peter Jackson movie again because it's been a while.
Isn't that neat?
It's just nice. It just feels good. I think the last time I liked one was King Kong. And even that, like, I haven't seen it since it was in theaters. But I liked it back then. That's all I can care about.
So don't go back to it. Preserve that memory.
Preserve King Kong. Yeah, I mean, fair enough. But otherwise, then it would be Lord of the Rings, which, you know. I mean, Lord of the Rings is great, but They Should Not Grow Old, I think, is a really good movie from Peter Jackson. And he's talking about his next movie will be another documentary, kind of doing the same thing about the Beatles and about the recording of Let It Be, which, because you can never have enough Beatles documentaries, I guess, but...
If they do it like this, or it's Peter Jackson, like, I'm in, I guess.
Yeah, I think it sounds cool, and that could actually be a really good companion piece to the Ron Howard documentary that came out a couple years ago, which was about like the touring years, and this would be about the studio years, whereas they're not touring. Like, that'd be kind of cool. But anyway, yeah, so that is They Should Not Grow Old, and it's still in theaters right now, probably not for much longer, but you should go check it out if you can. And see it in IMAX 3D if you can, which is how I saw it, because that is like the way to see it. Like, the movie begins, like the first 20 minutes of the movie is like the old stock footage, like it's not restored, and it's just like, and I was watching it, and I was like, you know, like, people kept saying this is, like, really good-looking footage. And, like, yeah, I mean, it looks good. But then, like, at a certain point, once you actually get into the trench, like, all the lead-up into the trench is, like, all the old stock footage. And then once it gets into the trench, the image starts to get bigger and bigger and starts to take up the whole screen, and like, the color starts coming in. And it's a mind-blowing watch in 3D and IMAX. But, yeah, that's They Shall Not Grow Old. And then I wanted to bring attention to a couple of other movies that would not have been on my radar if not for the Oscars, actually.
Wow, what a twist.
Yeah. You know, we give a lot of shit to the Oscars, you're right, and I think deservedly so, especially this year. But the thing the Oscars are useful for is, you know, they bring attention to movies that might not have attention brought to them otherwise. And that was the case for these two movies for me, and that's speaking for me, like somebody who's really into movies and like is usually on top of this kind of stuff. The first one is Cold War, which is nominated for Best Foreign Film this year, and Cinematography, and Best Director, which was kind of the big shock of all the nominations this year, was that Pavel Polakowski got nominated for Best Director for this movie. And it's very good. It's a drama about a love affair that takes place over the course of about 15 to 20 years as a couple leaves Poland and makes their way to France during the Cold War. And I liked it. You know, it's pretty. It's very affecting. It's also very short. It's like 88 minutes, which is like, great. I was really,
what a change. That's so nice.
You know, there's so many like bleak foreign movies that are like 4 hours long, and some of them are amazing, but like it's nice to have one that I can like get in and out under 2 hours, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is Cold War. Cinematography is amazing, the direction's very good. The lead actress looks suspiciously like Kate McKinnon, to the point where I was like, is this Polish Kate McKinnon? Is this her long lost Polish twin? But it's very good. I like Cold War a bit. And then I also saw Mirai, which was the a new animated feature nominated for Best Animated Film. It was the only animated movie that I hadn't seen out of the five that are nominated. And it's an anime from Mamoru Hosada about a young kid struggling with his place within his family after his younger sister is born. And this kid's, like, you know, 3 years old. And I thought this was, like, hit or miss for the most part. It mixes in some fantasy elements, and it has some success with some stuff and less success with others. But it has some incredible animation, especially towards the end. And I think the ending was great. So the ending is really powerful and affecting. So overall, I came out on a positive side with Mirai. And I'm not a big anime guy, so, like, that's a pretty huge... that's a great review for me. I will say.
This movie was sort of all right, which is saying a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's Cold War Mirai. Have you been following either of these movies? I mean, I think Cold War might have been on your radar after the Best Director thing.
Yeah, I had heard of it. I think me and you might have talked about it. But I hadn't heard of Mirai, though. So that's kind of interesting.
Okay, and EJ, what about you? Had you followed either of these movies?
Cold War played at the Spectrum Movie Theater by me a few weeks ago. And I missed it.
What a shame.
Both those movies I've been actually heavily interested in. The New York Times, I think, always covers foreign films really, really well. And they've been talking high praise from those movies ever since they first even started coming over here for limited screenings in the West. So those are two movies I'm definitely trying to check out.
All right, awesome. Yeah, so that's Cold War and Mirai. And then finally, I got one last thing I wanted to mention here. And I've talked about this in the podcast a little bit in the past. But I wanted to say that I have been on and off watching the television program Cheers for the last, like, 2 years now. Like, it's been, like, an on and off kind of thing. And I finally finished the show. And I got
the whole thing.
The whole thing, all 11 seasons, something like 275 episodes. And I got to tell you, Cheers, pretty good.
Yeah, I got the answer.
Somehow I knew you would. Comfortable shoes. Shoes.
Yeah, if you're not wearing comfortable shoes, life is just chaos. I mean, the greatest accomplishments in history have been made by men wearing accommodating shoes. Oh, Fraser, tell me, who do you think is the greatest thinker in all of mankind?
I don't know, Aristotle?
There you go. Sandals. Perhaps the most comfortable shoe there is. You hardly even know they have them on. I mean, Confucius, thongs. Einstein, loose loafers. Wow.
You know, no one wants to be the first to say it, but I'm not ashamed to admit what I think we're all feeling. The time goes by so fast. People move in and out of your life. You must never miss an opportunity to tell these people how much they mean to you. Well, I
keep coming back to that shoe thing.
Wow.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, obviously. I loved the show. It was great. And I watched it. I started watching it 2 years ago because I had received TV the Book for Christmas, which was a book written by Matt Zolotaitis and Alan Sepinwall, two critics who I've followed for a very long time. And it's a book that counts down the 100 greatest TV shows of all time. And Cheers came in at number 5. And there was a couple of shows in the top 10 that I hadn't watched. And I was like, well, I'm going to, you know, try to watch one of these shows. And Cheers just seemed like the easiest to get done because it was like, it's a sitcom, it's a half-hour show. And it ended up becoming a show that, like, just became, like, great comfort food for me over the past couple of years. Like, something I could just watch and enjoy when I wasn't in the mood for anything. Like, if I wanted to watch a movie or watch like, some kind of show, but I just couldn't get couldn't get it in my head to decide on something, I was like, all right, let's put on Cheers. It was great for that. And honestly, when I got to the end of season 11, it ends with this, you know, three-part finale. The last, like, three episodes all are technically part of, like, a three-parter of one episode. And, like, getting into, like, those last three episodes was a very emotional experience, guys.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and it's a great finale, by the way, which, you know, I'm not the first person to say that. It's generally considered one of the better TV finales. And also, I think the second most watched TV finale of all time when it first aired on TV, behind MASH.
Wow.
So yeah, Cheers. You know, I'm not saying anything new by saying that Cheers is good. But Cheers is good, and I think I'm going to give it a little bit of time and then probably move on to Frasier, which was the spinoff of Cheers, and hope that I have a similar experience, because that could be like a great, like, the next great show for me, because that's another 11-season show.
Jesus Christ.
So that could be another 2 years of my life that are spent watching Frasier.
Hey, man. I'm glad for you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Anyway, so that wraps up my discussions, guys, and now I think finally we can move on into our review of The Lego Movie 2, the second part.
Once, everything was awesome. Now, everything is bleak.
Hey, Lucy! I brought you coffee!
Coffee. The bitter liquid that provides the only semblance of pleasure left in these dark times.
Oh my goshness, did I interrupt you brooding just now?
Times have changed. You need to change with them. We have to be tough and battle ready.
Look, a shooting star, make a wish!
Oh no.
Run! Hurry! The door is slowly closing!
Oh, the pain. It's getting so cold.
Emmett, what are you doing?
Hooray!
See, that wasn't so bad. Nothing got in.
Ah, something got in.
I'm General Mayhem. Bring me your fiercest leader.
Lucy!
Emmett!
All right, that was from the trailer for The Lego Movie 2, the second part. The new movie written by Phil Lord and Chris Miller and directed by Mike Mitchell. This stars Chris Pratt, Elizabeth Banks, Will Arnett, Tiffany Haddish, Stephanie Beatriz, Charlie Day, Alison Brie, Nick Offerman, and Maya Rudolph, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for The Lego Movie 2 reads, "It's been 5 years since everything was awesome." And the citizens are facing a huge new threat. Lego Duplo invaders from outer space, wrecking everything faster than they can rebuild. So, the Lego movie, I think we're all in agreement, was basically a perfect movie. And
it's pretty close.
Yeah, and it took a lot of people by surprise by how great that movie was. I mean, this time, Phil Lord and Chris Miller were pretty known at that point. They had made 21 Jump Street at that point. They had made Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. And, of course, they were the creators of Clone High, which was one of the best shows of all time.
Who could forget it, you know?
Who could forget? One of my favorites. So, you know, they came out with the Lego movie, and, like, I was excited for it because I loved Phil Lord and Chris Miller already. But I think, you know, people who weren't already on the Lord Miller hype train like I was, were maybe like, oh, what is this Lego movie that people keep talking about? Why are we making movies about Legos? How droll. But obviously we're all fans. I mean, EJ, why don't you speak a little bit about how you like Lego, your thoughts on Lego movie, the first one.
I mean, I grew up with Legos my entire life. I can date all the way back since I was probably like 5 or 6, and my mom spent God knows how much money getting me the full Harry Potter Lego set that had come out at that time.
Yeah.
Damn, girl.
Yeah, and, like, you know, going, you know, seeing all those presents and stuff, and you open each one, and it's just another, like, room at Hogwarts in a classroom, or,
sure.
You know, and, like, it just built from there. I can remember just building my own versions of Lego City and right in my living room. I had all the Johnny Thunder Lego sets, if anyone remembers who Johnny Thunder is. Because he was the ripoff Indiana Jones dinosaur hunter dude.
Oh, yeah. I kind of remember that. That was before they had the license to Indiana Jones.
Yeah. I had all the Spider-Man sets with that. Had, like, the Lego Steven Spielberg director dude. And it came with its own camera so you could film your own, like, superhero action movie stuff.
Oh, yeah. I kind of remember all that, yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, Star Wars Legos. I still play with Star Wars Legos.
Yes. when I came back to New York from Montana, and I came to visit you guys up in Albany, I found this room that is just, like, literally covered, like, head to toe in Legos and Star Wars Legos. And it's a pretty amazing sight.
It's only gotten bigger.
I bet.
So long story short, my excitement for the Lego movie, I mean, obviously I was a little apprehensive at first, I guess you could say. You know, like, we've seen other games and nostalgic children's toys from our own past get their own movie rights, like Battleship and Transformers and stuff like that. So, you know, and at the heart of it, you know, at Lego, it's a kids movie and stuff, you know, like, the big question I had was, you know, like, where's the magic going to come from, so to speak? Like,
right.
You know, what's the point of going to see this? What's the point of taking my children to see this? You know, the first three quarters of the movie, there's a ton of heart. The pacing is very breezy. It keeps you invested. It feels like every single line is a zinger or a one-liner,
yep.
a joke of some kind. And even gets to the point where the movie plays off itself, even has its own references and stuff. And then the final quarter of the movie, the last quarter mile, you know, to the finish line, so to speak, it hits you that this whole time it was just a kid playing with his dad's Lego set. I thought that idea at first when I saw it was one of the coolest ideas I've ever seen a movie do, let alone a kid's movie, because that is the heart and soul of playing with your Legos, you know, outside of building these amazing sets and stuff, is you can use your imagination and do whatever the heck you want with those Legos, whether or not you want to tear apart those sets, because I would never touch my Star Wars Legos like that, at least.
Of course.
And Johnny Thunder, yeah, you're gone. Like, sorry, you're in the city now. But that for me, that was so eye-opening and so jaw-dropping and so inspiring to see that, that level of creativity that I feel like only Chris Lord and Phil Miller
Phil Lord and Chris Miller.
Butcher their names. No, I knew that. And the whole time I'm telling myself, do not butcher their names, DJ, because you do that all the time passing. But you guys know who I'm saying. Yes. We're all in the same boat.
Yeah.
Anyways, so I really thought this was something that only those two guys could actually really could accomplish. And I don't know, just going from like the whole like first part of the movie and just feeling that heart and then just see where it took it. Like I don't really have the words to really express that, like how much that kind of meant to me, someone that has a lot of emotion, a lot of nostalgia and a lot of stories of my childhood that are just focused around Legos. And that was ultimately kind of the biggest question that I had going into this next Lego movie was, where do they go with that? You know, how do you pull the heartstrings? How do you make me laugh my ass off for, you know, a good 2 hours, hour and a half, 2 hours, and then tug on those heartstrings the way they did the first movie with the whole relationship with Will Ferrell, the actor, and his son.
Right.
And, yeah, so I don't know what else to say about that. I mean, without crying. you know, Legos are really a huge deal, and... It was really for the first movie. It was really exciting, and it seemed really fresh at the time to see that level of creativity. Where you know we're not actually in a way watching a movie. We're in somebody else's imagination playing with Legos, and that was really cool to me.
Yeah, definitely. So, Mike, I mean, what's your take on the first Lego movie, the original?
The original one, like EJ said, that reveal when it turns out. It's like a kid playing with Legos the whole time.
Yeah.
Is one of the like, you know, top 10 like anime twists. No. but yeah, like I really enjoyed the first one. I don't have a ton of nostalgia myself about Legos, like in particular. So, and I feel like I don't know if I have my timelines exactly straight, but it feels like this was announced in that, like, you know, like EJ mentioned, Battleship and Transformers had been a thing already, and you know, the Emoji Movie and like all this shit where we're just like cashing in on like fads.
The Emoji
name.
Movie happened a couple years later. Honestly, the Emoji Movie probably happened because the Lego Movie was a huge hit.
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong, but I just mean like that kind of trend, like that you know, that mindset of like, we're just cashing in on name brands, who cares what the movie is, like,
right.
Whatever. When it was first announced, that was probably my first initial reaction. And then I saw, like, in trailers, I saw, like, what the animation style was, and then it was going to be all Legos, like, everything was Lego, and
yes.
Wow, that's like, in, like, you know, Lord and Miller revolutionizing animation again,
right.
First with this, and then now Spinjit
and Spider-Verse. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, and then the movie came out, and it's absolutely hilarious, and one of the big, like, the crazy thing was they had the rights to all these properties, and that's insane, but they're Legos. It's so adorable. Like, it's Lego Justice League and Lego Gandalf and yeah. You know, all this stuff that's going on, and it was great. And then it, you know, pulls this twist, like EJ said, about the heartstrings, and yeah, I had a blast with the first Lego movie, and... I guess we'll wait and see what I have to say about the second one.
Oh, boy. Well, I will say, I think you guys are overestimating the hugeness of the reveal at the end of the Lego movie. I think it's a very effective reveal, and I think it does tug at the heartstrings, like, a little bit towards the end, but, like, the actual reveal itself, like, I don't know, it's not bad by any means. I love the Lego movie, it's just...
Clearly someone didn't play with Legos when they were a kid.
I played with plenty of Legos when I was a kid, sir.
Says the kid who played with no Legos.
I just really enjoyed...
You're right. I was a Megablocks household. That is my great shame.
Knew it.
I just really enjoyed the way it was. It like because it, you know, it's very meta and there's a lot of stuff. I forget what they call the crazy glue.
The Kraggle.
Kraggle, yeah. Yes. Like, you know, there's like a lot of real world stuff going on in the Lego movie. Yes. It's like, this is silly and fun because, like, oh, we all know Legos are toys. And then it, like, becomes like, oh, yeah, it's actually this kid making up this story. And
right.
I'm like, oh, that's nice.
Yes.
It's good.
Yes, I would agree with that. But, yeah, this time around, though, Lego Movie 2, Phil Lord and Chris Miller are no longer directing. They are back as screenwriters, although this movie went through a couple of different phases of writers. I know at one point Raphael Bob Waskser, the creator of BoJack Horseman, was writing this movie. At one point, Rob Schraub was directing this movie, who directs a lot of episodes of Community and worked with Dan Harmon a lot. And I think the original plan was for Lord Miller to come back to direct, but they got hired to make a Star Wars movie that shall go nameless. And so but when they got fired from said Star Wars movie, you know, they kind of came back, and I think they did a rewrite of the Lego Movie 2 script, as well as kind of getting more involved in Spider-Verse. And I think that was probably a good thing for both movies. But this one, instead of being directed by Lord Miller, is directed by a guy named Mike Mitchell, who was the director of Trolls for DreamWorks a couple of years ago.
Wow.
And if you look at his filmography, I don't have it on hand, but it's like, I think he also did like Alvin and the Chipmunks 3 or something like that. Like, it's not like... It's not great stuff.
all the stuff the original Lego movie dunked on.
Pretty much, yeah, which is kind of funny when you think about it. But I think for this movie, I would say that the change in direction shows. I think the movie might not be as visually inventive as the first one in some cases. And I would also say that it does start to lose a little bit of steam in its last, like, 20 minutes and underuses some of its supporting cast from the first movie. Those are the only criticisms I have about Lego Movie 2. I loved this movie. I wanted to get all the negative stuff out there as quickly as possible because I just had a blast with Lego Movie 2. I thought it was a lot of fun, almost as good as the first one, I thought. You know, it's, but again, like, I think without Lord Miller in the director's chair, it's noticeably, and it might just be because we've had a couple of Lego movies at this point. Like, we had the Lego movie, and then we had Lego Batman, and then the Lego Ninjago movie. Like, but all of those came out in pretty quick succession, and so I think we're just used to how Lego movies look at this point. It's not the novelty that the first one was, but I also think Mike Mitchell doesn't handle the action sequences like as inventively as Phil and Chris Miller do in the first one. Like in the first one, there are, you know, whole sequences that are like burned into my brain. You know, like action sequence wise, like, you know, there's the heist sequence trying to get into the building, and there's, you know, the first thing where Emmett has to break out of the prison and stuff, and it's a lot of fun stuff. And this one has action scenes, and some of they're fun while you're watching them, but they're not like burned in my mind like they were when I saw the first one. And maybe it's because I saw the first one like 10 times. Like, who knows? Who's to say? But I just feel like direction-wise, this movie is a little bit lacking compared to the first one. But anyway, outside of that, I had a blast with the movie. EJ, what's your overall take on Lego Movie 2?
I agree with you pretty much on all your points. So I'm a little disappointed because I really can't contribute anything more to what you just said. Yes, it did seem you did notice the difference in the direction. Overall, this movie is definitely a little bit more forgettable than the first one. Like, there aren't too many scenes that are really going to, I feel like, stick with me. I loved the reveal at the end, though, as much as I did in the first one.
Okay,
I thought that was a really cool idea. I really wasn't...
Yeah, remember, we're not in spoilers yet. We'll talk about spoilers later on, but...
I've already fudged up this podcast enough, and I still will never get over screwing up Phil Lord and Chris Miller's names. I know if I just say their last names, Lord and Miller, I'll slip and I'll say Lord and Taylor. And that won't be fun. Yeah, I feel like, like I said, going back to my point, I feel like there wasn't anything terribly revolutionary about this. It didn't reinvent the wheel. I didn't feel like it had to. It kept the same pace. It had so many fun jokes. I was cracking up more than the kids that were kicking my chair behind me. I don't know. Honestly, it's I feel like it doesn't even have to do that much with my connection with Legos and playing with Legos in my childhood. I just think these are really quality movies. I think there's actually like a really communicable lesson there for children and for adults, and just playing and being creative and imaginative and stuff, and all that Disney hullabaloo that we learned as kids.
Fair enough. And how about Mike? What's your overall take on Lego Movie 2?
My overall take, I feel like I might be a little more lukewarm than either of you. Now, I did really like this movie, but I had that feeling you sort of mentioned it, or both of you sort of mentioned it, where it's like, it's – I kind of walked out and was like, what happened? Like, what'd I see? It feels very much like much more like filler movie than the first one did to me. And that might be like a product of, I saw this straight after work. Like it was like, I went straight home for 10 minutes and then went back to like, went out to the movies, had my jacket on like a blanket, cause it was kind of cold and like was falling in and out of sleep like a little bit.
Okay.
So that like, that's 100% like might be just on me. But I still really liked it for the most part. It did feel kind of retreading a lot of the same stuff, like trying the joke a second time for some of the things, which like, okay, sure, I guess it's fine. And this one feels much more meta than the first one did. Like it's hyper aware of everything that like, now that we have this reveal, you know, now that we don't need to like pretend we don't know there's like a real world story going on.
Right.
Kind of thing from the first one, you know. They're able to play with that a lot more and make references to that, like, device that they're using, that we know that there's kids playing with these Legos and stuff.
Right.
So that, like, that's fun. And I do, like, appreciate how, like, grimdark everything is, like, as, like, you know, they make a lot of jokes about that stuff. So that, yes. that part of it was fun. But overall, I can't help but compare it to the first one, and I love that movie so much that I think it just... like, didn't quite meet my expectations that I was hoping for. And it might be because, like you said earlier, that, you know, we've had these three other movies. And Lego Batman's, like, amazing. Oh, my God. you know, like, and I was like, I don't even know if it quite reaches Lego Batman for me.
Really?
I don't know. Like, it might just because of when I saw it that, like, I wasn't ready or wasn't, like, you know, wasn't that invested because I was tired and stuff. I didn't fall asleep, like, all the way. I just want to clarify that. But it was definitely, like, zoned out for a little while. So that might be part of it. If I saw it again, like, you know, on a Saturday afternoon or whatever, like, fully engaged, I might like it more. But I still did overall enjoy it. It's still fun. It's still a fun Lego movie. Like, come on. That's not going to be bad.
Yeah, to your point, like, I do agree in a sense. Like, it did feel more like Lego Movie Part 2 than, like, an actual full-blown sequel to the Lego Movie, because there were, you know, there were callbacks to, like, the first one, or at least there were a similar structure to, like, some of the jokes and just how they were trying to push Emmett through the story, more or less.
Yeah.
So I totally see where you're coming through with that. But, yeah, for me, it's Legos.
For me, it's Legos. That should be on the poster, honestly. I guess I'm a little disappointed in your take on the movie, Mike, because I know. I saw this movie on Thursday night. It was opening night, and it was like me and like six other people in the theater, and none of them were kids, by the way. It was all like adults, nice. Like me, and I was like obnoxious laughing the entire time. I couldn't help myself. This script is just like jam packed with, you know, I think terrific Lord and Miller jokes. I think the voice work is fantastic. I think the meta humor really works for me. The first movie is really meta too. I think you're underselling how meta that movie is. This one definitely is more meta. I think in the same way that, like, if looking at other Lord and Miller movies, 22 Jump Street is a much more meta movie than 21 Jump Street, even though they're both working in meta territory.
Right.
But, you know, it's just filled with, like, you know, self-referential humor and, like, really oddball references that, like, shouldn't be in a kid's movie. That, like, I can't help but be charmed by it. There's a hot tub time machine joke in this movie, guys.
Yeah, like what? I mean...
In the year of our Lord 2019, they decided to make a hot tub time machine joke. It's insane.
Yeah, I don't want to say that I didn't think it was funny, because I definitely did. I was laughing a lot. I was enjoying, for the most part. I just feel like... there was something missing for me, and it's like, I don't know, I can't quite put my finger on what it was. It might be, you know, the second act might drag a long time when we get to, like, where we're going, and it might be the lack of the supporting cast, like, all the other crazy properties that made Lego Movie for 1 so much fun for me, because a lot of that's not particularly there.
Yeah, there's a little bit of it in this movie, but it doesn't rely as much as the first one did on, like, hey, it's Han Solo jumping in the, you know,
that,
it doesn't do that as much. There's definitely some of that in this movie.
No, absolutely.
Yeah,
but and there might have been, like, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, but there's not, like, a scene in the first one where it's, like, Morgan Freeman is just, like, listing off names that are in, like, the room with them, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, so that's kind of really it. I don't know if that's what was missing for me, and like to get me like all the way to be like totally engaged or what, but something wasn't quite working overall. Okay. But I still enjoyed it.
Interesting. I will say, I think you know, you mentioned the framing device before. Like, obviously, we know at this point that these Legos are being played with by these kids. Right. And the movie obviously plays into that right away because it has to. Like, we already know that that's a thing. And I think it does something really interesting with that. You know, the first movie plays it as a reveal that you're really watching a kid in the real world play with his dad's Legos, and it ends with his sister joining him. And that, you know, obviously it looks like it's about to create conflict, like, at the end of that movie. So it can't be a reveal again, so it places it in the foreground. And I think it's fascinating to watch both of their, like, childlike perspectives at play and at war with each other throughout the movie, reflected in the characters. Because, you know, yeah. depending on how characters interact with each other, you can be like, oh, now the sister is playing with these Legos. Oh, and now the brother is playing with these. Like, you can, it kind of, like, shifts perspective back and forth. Like, there's one of my favorite moments very early on is when the Duplos attack them, right, in, like, the opening scene. It picks up right where the first movie left off.
It pulls a Rocky.
Yeah, exactly. And Metalbeard says something along those lines, like, I'm firing my laser at you. And one of the Duplo things, like, swallows it and is like, I eat lasers. And and Metalbeard turns, like, it turns into, like, the exasperated older brother for a second. It's like, that's not how this works.
Yeah, and there was the one right after that when Batman hits it with the Batarang. She's like, you didn't hit me. He's like, yes, I did. It's amazing. Like, oh, that's perfect.
Yeah. And I feel like there's a lot of that throughout the movie that that I thought was really interesting. And I thought the switching of perspectives between the characters I thought was really cool.
I agree. Very astute of you, Mike.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you. Also wanted to give a special shout out as far as voice work goes. I think Tiffany Haddish is amazing in this movie. She plays the shape-shifting Queen Whatever Wanabi or whatever Wanabi or whatever. But she's great in this movie. And Chris Pratt also gets to do a dual role this time around where he's playing Emmett from the first movie and also Rex Danger Vest, who acts as a parody of every other movie role that Chris Pratt has had.
Yep.
And he's sort of doing like a John Wayne impression while he's doing it. It's great.
Yes. I was like, is he doing a Snake Plissken? No, he's doing John Wayne, which is really Kurt Russell. Like, it's like a whole thing. It's great.
It's all circular. But like, as far as like, you know, movies where Chris Pratt plays a raptor trainer goes, I mean, this has got to be the best one so far.
Yeah. One out of three. Yeah. Killing it.
But yeah, do you have any other like standout like voice actors you want to like throw out there in this movie, guys?
I mean, you nailed it for me with Tiffany Haddish. I mean, Nick Offerman. I always forget Nick Offerman is
Metalbeard.
Metalbeard. I think he's a wonderful pirate.
Yes.
I thought it was. Is it Tom Kenny who's the voice of SpongeBob?
Yeah, he's the voice of SpongeBob. Like, you thought it was Tom Kenny?
Because he also does the pirates and the painting. Right. I was like, what the fuck? Like, what? And then at the end credits, so I was like, oh, yeah, it's Nick Offerman.
Yeah,
that's no, right.
Nick Offerman's actually a really good voice actor. He does voices in a lot of different things, but you can never tell it's like Nick Offerman. He always puts on like a weird voice. Which is, you know, he's somebody with a very distinctive voice from Parks and Rec. So, like, you know, like, you would know his voice if you heard it, but he always does a different thing with it. So I actually appreciate that a lot about him. But also, Will Arnett as Batman, still fantastic in this movie.
Yeah.
I also like they referenced the Lego Batman movie at one point, like early on. They say something like the Justice League is leaving, and they're like, hey, where's Batman? It's like, oh, he's having some kind of side adventure.
Yeah, which I didn't even realize till much later. I was like, oh, that's funny, because like, I thought they were just referencing the movies. Like the actual Justice League movies. And like, oh, there's going to be like a Batman standalone movie, maybe. Yeah. I was like, oh, that's funny. And then I was like, oh, wait, there's a Lego Batman movie.
Yeah. There was one point where Batman says something like, how many movies have they made about you? It's like zero. It's like, yeah. They made 9 about me with 3 in various stages of development. And, like, and again, it's that meta humor that I love so much in these movies because they don't belong in these kids' movies. Does not belong at all. It's kind of what makes it great. Also want to reference the fact this movie is kind of a musical. Which the first one was not. The first one had Everything Is Awesome as like the theme song, but like otherwise, like it's not a musical. This movie has like a lot of musical numbers in it, and I think they're all awesome. They're really great.
I thought it was very like, you know, another one of the meta moments where somebody's like, oh no, wait a second, and then like we start getting all these songs, which is great. I thought one of them in particular was that first song, I think, with Tiffany Haddish, where she does, I forget what the. I'm Not Evil or something
song,
like that.
The song is
or,
called Not Evil, and it's like a villain song, but it's like she's referencing the fact that she's not a villain.
Which is great. I love that song. I thought that was really funny.
That was hilarious.
But then the other one, like the song gets stuck in your head thing.
Catchy
I was
song.
Like, this is catchy song. Is that what it was called? That's what it's called.
Yeah, recorded by T-Pain, by the way.
Oh my God. Of course it was. that song was the moment, like, or one of the moments where I was like, oh, we're just trying to do the first one. Like, that felt like just trying to get Everything Is Awesome again. like recapture that. Which, but like at the same time, this movie's so meta that of course they're doing that and they're making fun of the fact that they're doing that. But like I can't tell if I should give them credit for that because at the same time you're still just doing it. It's kind of the same way how I feel about like Jurassic World. Like you don't get to pretend you're smart by just doing the thing you're making fun of.
Like, okay. Fair enough. I will say I really liked Catchy Song. I thought that was a blast.
That's fair.
And I thought it was very funny send up pop music, which Everything Is Awesome also was, which also gets representation here as well as a remix of the song by Garfunkel and Oates in the beginning, which was pretty fantastic.
Oh, yeah, the tween remix, right?
The tween remix. And then there's like a kind of variation of it called Everything's Not Awesome that they sing at one point. And then the new end credits song also is it's Beck, Robin, and the Lonely Island singing about how great the end credits are. And it's... fantastic. That's great. And then Tiffany Haddish and Will Arnett actually have one like duet song, which I think might be my favorite of the movie, called Gotham City Guys.
I forgot about that.
We'll reference that one in spoilers, I think, because there is some pretty great stuff in there. But yeah, overall, I think, you know, I would agree this movie is not as like perfectly structured as the original movie is. And I think the fact that Lord and Miller are not here as directors, but instead are just screenwriters and producers, like their influence is definitely still felt. You know, I think having a little bit more of their visual eye might have been helpful for this movie. But I laughed very loudly, pretty much nonstop throughout the movie. So I'm calling it a win. I had a blast with it. I thought it was a lot of fun. And you kind of get towards the end and it's like, it does some stuff that like I was a little questionable about, but it kind of pulls it back. I'll talk about it in the spoilers, but overall I had a blast with it. And, it sounds like you guys enjoyed it at least, right?
I had a good time with it. I don't think I quite liked it as much as you guys, but I still like in the positive, still liked it.
All right, cool. All right, let's move on to spoilers for The Lego Movie 2, starting right now. All right, spoilers for The Lego Movie 2, the second part, starting right now. So, guys, I guess spoilers for the video game Infamous also, because this has the same ending as the PS3 video game Infamous, which...
What?
Wow. he just opens my world, too.
Yeah. Did I just blow your mind, EJ?
Yeah, I totally forgot about that. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. In the video game Infamous, Mike, the villain turns out to be the hero from the future all along. That's the big twist.
What a twist.
It's the big twist at the end of Infamous, and it's the big twist at the end of The Lego Movie 2. Rex Dangervest turns out to be the villain of the movie, and then turns out to also be Chris Pratt from the future. And I gotta say, I love the reveal that Tiffany Haddish is not the villain after all.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we referenced her song before called Not Evil, where she's, like, very unconvincingly singing about how she's not the villain.
Yeah. Right?
And about how not evil she is. And there's some great lines in that song about how she's, like, you know, buttering up all the different supporting characters. My favorite line, actually, is when she says to Benny, the spaceman, she's like, don't you think spaceships are great? And he's like, are you kidding? Loving spaceships is my one defining trait. And, like, you know, there's, again, that meta humor, which I love. But, you know, when they reveal that Tiffany Haddish is not the villain and Lucy, like, just has this exasperated reaction, like, what? That was real?
You sang a whole song about it.
Yeah, like, that was pretty fantastic. But, yeah, so
what does it turn out Rex stands for? It's like...
Oh, it's like something Emin Extreme, like, yeah. Something along those lines.
Anyway.
But what did you guys think of the twist, of the fact that Rex Dangervous was... Emmett from the future, who traveled back in time and is sabotaging everything.
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a very fun way to kind of visualize or show like the way your future is not like set in stone, right? Like, you know, we kind of talk like there's a moment at the end when Rex and Emmett are fighting in the Undar system of Dryer or whatever. Yeah. Like when they're under the Dryer fighting, which is I love that. Where he says, like, this is all a metaphor for the death of the imagination in an adolescent while they're fighting. It's like, oh, my God, that's great. Like, that's such a – I really enjoyed the way they were able to, you know, work that meta humor in. And at the same time, just because shit seems bad now doesn't mean it's going to be bad in the future. And you can always attempt to make things better, right? And especially as a young adolescent, that doesn't seem possible ever. So let's talk about eighth grade again. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, fair enough. EJ, what did you think of the twist?
If you guys weren't my friends already, you would know how big of an idiot I am. Because the whole movie, I was obsessed over with the fact that Chris Pratt was Rex. Like, that was his voice. He was also doing the voice of Rex.
Yeah.
And I was so I was obsessed with, like, oh my gosh, like, how is this playing to the movie? How is this playing to the plot? To the point where I was even self-doubting myself and was, like, trying to, like, take my phone out to IMDb to see if it was, like, Paul Rudd doing a voice or something. Yeah, so I was equally surprised and kind of kicking myself when it turned out that, you know, it was just Chris Pratt from the future, or Emmett from the future. I swear I was literally running through my mind of any actor in Hollywood who could possibly play off some sort of Chris Pratt-like voice. As if Lord and Miller, you know, weren't going to take a meta route or try and take it just a basic just playing off of the main character a little too overhanded with a similar sounding voice to be his kind of mentor in this movie. So yeah, I mean, I dug it. It made a lot of sense to me, but I'm still going to, you know, slightly be frustrated myself for thinking Paul Rudd had a role in this movie.
maybe he does, and we just don't know.
Yeah, I'm just going to have to live with
that. You never know. I mean, there are a ton of, like, small cameo roles throughout the movie, including my favorite, which was Lego Bruce Willis.
Oh, my God, I forgot about that.
Oh, yes.
Which was incredible. He only has a couple lines, but Lucy's like, I think it's Lucy who's traveling through the ducts, and she sees Bruce Willis, like, traveling there. He's like, I don't live in the ducts. Don't worry about it. And, like, just keeps going, which was pretty great. So Lego Bruce Willis was an amazing cameo. But, I mean, Will Forte came back as Lego Abraham Lincoln. Ben Schwartz plays Barnarnar, the banana creature, which I
my favorite
loved.
Character.
Yeah, he was amazing.
My new favorite character.
The bit where he slips during the wedding and falls down and he's shouting like, "This is my nightmare!" And, like, it was incredible. Jason Momoa is in this movie playing Aquaman, guys.
I wondered. I recognized that. My man! Yes. I was like, is that actually him?
Yeah, that was actually Jason Momoa.
That's amazing.
It's quite a year to be in, where Aquaman's playing Aquaman in the Lego movie like that.
Yeah. Apparently
that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. Apparently they tried to get Gal Gadot actually to be in as Wonder Woman as well, because she didn't play her in the first movie. That was Colby Smulders. And I think she actually recorded some stuff, but something came up or whatever. So Colby Smulders ended up coming back to play Wonder Woman again in this movie. Instead of Gal Gadot, but
there's so many Wonder Women in this.
There are a couple of different Wonder Women, which was that was a little strange, but maybe not that strange considering that was mostly the girls' toys, and so it would kind of make sense that a girl would have multiple versions of the Wonder Woman toy. Sure, but Margot Robbie has a very brief cameo as Harley Quinn in this movie. She has one line towards the beginning. That's basically it. And that was a role that Jenny Slate voiced in the Lego Batman movie, but that got Margot Robbie in it this time around. But yeah, there was, you know, just so much in this movie that I really liked. And like I said before, this I want to get back to the twist a little bit, because when it was happening, like, I wasn't sure if it was working for me, like, the way it happened, because the way Rex describes it happening was, like, you know, Emmett got jettisoned from the table and he spent like years under the dryer. But the thing is, like we saw that situation happen to Emmett in the first movie. Like, the first time he exits the Lego movie realm and he enters the real world, like, he gets, like, you know, stuck under the thing or whatever. And, like, in that movie, you know, his friends are in trouble and he starts to move around and, like, on his own and get back and starts to save the day. And then in this movie, he just becomes, like, very brooding and, like, dark and futuristic. And when that was happening, I was like, I'm not sure if this is working for me. But then the movie makes it very clear, like you said before, Rex Ingevis even has a line where he's like, this is all happening inside the mind of an adolescent and that kind of thing. And so when that's happening, when the movie starts to make it clear that everything is happening in the subconscious of this adolescent kid wrestling with himself, the inconsistency, like, sort of makes sense in retrospect, because it's sort of about that kid growing up. Or trying to be more adult, but at the same, like, you know, not wanting to play with his, you know, younger baby sister, and wanting to, like, kind of claim some territory for himself. And that's why, you know, the Lego paradise that we've seen in the first movie turns into, like, this Mad Max hellscape, you know, because he's trying to act older. And there's lines of dialogue where it's like, oh, the Matrix is a movie that only cool older kids get to watch. And, like, that kind
of
thing.
Yeah. What's he named? It used to be Bricksburg and now it's Apocalypseburg or something
It's Apocalypseburg, which I loved all the updates to, like the scene where, Emmett is wandering through listening to Everything Is Awesome, the Tween remix. And it's kind of going through all the same stuff that he went through, like, in the beginning of his day in the first movie, but, like, all the characters are changed now. So, like, Surfer Dave is, like, Chainsaw Dave. and you see the cats, like, going through, and it's like, oh, hey, Jeff, and the brow, and, like, keeps going.
The sewer babies.
Yeah, the sewer babies. It was great. So I love that contrast with the first movie that this one went for as well. But, yeah, and there's also, like, this one line in this movie that had me like obnoxious laughing for like 10 minutes straight. Like I was, I mean, there's a lot of lines that like I was laughing really hard and like I was probably annoying to the people in my theater around me. But I couldn't help it. Like I was just laughing so hard. But there was one line where Rex Dangerfest is talking to Lucy and he's talking about how tough the Emmett has gotten over the course of the movie. And he says something like, oh yeah, he's tough now. He's like a cookie that's so hard and tough that when you bite into it, you realize it's not even a cookie. It's a chainsaw.
Who doesn't love that?
And the thing is, the movie is filled with those kind of jokes. And so even when it's, you know, slightly less than the first movie, even if it's not like as structured as well, I still just had so much fun watching this movie. I think it's such a blast from beginning to end. Anything else you guys wanted to reference in spoilers while we're here?
Two things.
Okay.
My two favorite things in the movie, I just want to throw out there. When they said Marvel wouldn't return their calls,
right?
When they're asking why they didn't send more superheroes to the Justice League,
yeah.
And then secondly, at the wedding with the chocolate fondue fountain and the candy bar Lego goes like life is pain. That had me laughing more than everybody else in the theater. And yeah, those are at least the latter scene was something I think I'm gonna carry with me. It's the one thing I'll definitely carry with me from this movie for a long, long time, because that was I did not expect. I've seen these movies before. I've seen these directors in action. I didn't think it was gonna get that hilariously dark.
Yeah, and I do love how much this movie like makes fun of / references the, you know, like that 15-year-old edge thing that you think you have because you've been through it all. You're 16, you know, you're a young yes. adolescent. Like, I've experienced pain and loss. And it's like, okay. I mean, you might have, but like, it doesn't seem like it.
And even better, because the kid in this movie is like 11. You know, it's not like...
Yeah, that's true.
but it's like an 11-year-old kid who wants to seem older. You know, that totally yeah. makes sense. Also wanted to throw out there that the girl in the movie who plays the sister is Brooklyn Prince, who was the main character in The Florida Project.
Wow.
Yeah, so I didn't realize that until afterwards, but like, that was pretty wild.
Yeah, that's cool.
And Maya Rudolph plays their mom in this movie, and she gets a couple of like funny scenes out in the real world, which, you know, the first movie, like, you know, it was most of the heart scenes in the real world, but like there wasn't really like a ton of comedy there. Yeah. And this movie, like there's a scene where like Maya Rudolph steps on a Lego, and it's, you know, she has like, you know, very funny Maya Rudolph pain noises, and, you know, she like she's just really good at it. Also wanted to throw out there, I did mention before, the supporting cast from the first movie kind of takes a backseat in this one, and they do have their moments here and there, but, like, you know, Charlie Day gets to say spaceship, and, like, you know, yeah, Alison Brie gets to be Unikitty, and it's fun, but, like, they don't really get as many, like, memorable moments as they did in the first one. And Will Ferrell only has a cameo this time around. Like, he's only in the beginning and the end, you know, where he...
Is he even in it, or is it just his voice?
It's just his voice. Yeah, I mean, it's because I mean, in the first movie, yeah, he's in the live action segments too. And this one, he's not. But he has a cameo at the beginning and the end as Lord Business. And then in the live action segments, you hear his voice like twice. The second time you hear him was a great callback to "Where Are My Pants" from.
Yeah, that's
movie.
Right.
I love that. Like, that to me was like the best reveal of the movie, is to find out where is my pants came from.
Speaking about the supporting cast, there we go, like not being as utilized, I feel like that, like, kind of the middle second act where it's like we're gonna get married, you know, we want to talk about Gotham City Guys.
Oh yeah, I got to talk about that song.
Like, we're like Batman and Prince whatever I want to be, or whatever wannabe. Yeah. Like, we're gonna get married and stuff, and like Emmett's trying to save them. I feel like that kind of goes on, like, drags on a little bit, maybe, and it might be because we're not engaging with the whole cast. Like, Lucy, like, separates herself. You know, all the other people get brainwashed. We think Emmett is, like, everyone's kind of separate, which also plays into, like, this movie's like it's Star Wars. Like, like, a lot of times we even have like wipes across the screen between transitions.
You're
and
saying
stuff.
This is the Empire Strikes Back of Lego movies?
Yes. Which, oh man, hold on, because that means it's the best one. Oh, I've painted myself into a corner.
Boom.
Oh, wow.
You've been Star Wars.
You got me.
But yeah, we should talk about Gotham City Guys, the song, because that was, I think, possibly my favorite moment in the movie. I mean, the Not Evil song is also amazing, but Gotham City Guys, like, it's so, like, if you love Batman, like, just the,
yeah,
you know, it kind of feels like almost like a leftover from like a Batman movie, where it's so specifically incisive about Batman. Like, they reference every single actor who has played Batman at that point. And he's like, yeah, I've got Val Kilmer's look, or I've got Ben Affleck's looks and Val Kilmer's lips, and like that kind of thing. And that kind of thing. It was great. There's one line where like Tiffany Haddish and Will Arnett are just like, she's like, I didn't even like you when you looked like Christian Bale. I was like, I'm more of a Michael Keaton guy. And it's like, oh, I loved him as Beetlejuice. And like, that's not even a joke, but like, the way they say it is really funny.
Yeah, and Beetlejuice is there as a Lego.
Right.
For a second. That's great.
Yeah, it's delightful. But anyway, yeah. So is there anything else about the Lego Movie 2 you guys want to talk about before we wrap this up?
I want to shout out the montage at the end of time travel, where we go through like all the time travel movies. The TARDIS, the Hot Tub Time Machine, the yes. DeLorean, like Skynet. All that stuff. Skynet, yeah. Like, great.
Yeah, yeah. It's delightful. Again, just like another great meta... like weird bit. It feels like I'm pretty sure Phil Lord and Chris Miller are on a quest to make the most meta children's movies of all time. I believe that's their end goal, and they are succeeding with these Lego movies.
I did love the Raptors, which are the whole crew of Rex's ship, and their subtitles are incredible. Yes. Particularly in that segment when Rex goes back in time to 65 million BC to get a crew of raptors. He holds up a tennis ball, and all they're like, I love tennis! Is the subtitle of the raptors.
Yes. So good.
Amazing.
Yeah, so nice. And yeah, all the Rex Danger stuff, all the stuff that's parodying Chris Pratt's career, I thought was hilarious. They referenced the fact that he lost like a shitload of weight and became like chiseled and beefcake and all that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he was like, I'm a raptor trainer / galaxy defender / cowboy / archaeologist and like all that. Like, you know, just all these different like Chris Pratt roles, and even the Indiana Jones thing, which he was rumored to get for a long time.
Yeah.
It all gets worked in there, and I think it's very funny. But anyway, yeah, I believe that about wraps up our thoughts on Lego Movie 2, unless anybody has any final words.
Not really towards the Lego Movie 2, but I do want to, again, say thank you to you guys for allowing me to come on the podcast today.
Of course.
It really does mean a lot to me. I'm really sorry to Phil Lord and Chris Miller for messing up their names. And I'm sorry for the technical difficulties that I directly caused for the production of today.
It's okay. I'll have to deal with it, and hopefully it'll sound smooth.
You'll fix it in post.
When it comes
out. I think so.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah, and next time, I hopefully you guys will, for my sake, hopefully you guys invite me next time for something else that I can contribute some thoughts and opinions to and some commentary. So I'll definitely be very happy to do that for you guys. I had a lot of fun today. It was a blast.
Appreciate it, man. So, where can we find you online this week, EJ?
Online this week?
Yeah. This is what we do at the end of every podcast, by the way. It's
plug your stuff.
Yeah.
Plug whatever you want to plug.
Well, just come find me at Dr. Yeti Corella on Twitter. If you really want some, retweets over, politics. I'm all about that. I was all about that in 2018. I'm probably going to be obsessed with it in 2019.
All right.
I've been following the Mueller investigation like a hawk.
Okay. I'll plug EJ. Come baseball season, follow at Dr. Yeti Corella for some biting Royals commentary.
That's an understatement. Thank you.
Yes. All right. And Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at MD Film Blog on Twitter.
And you can find me at M. Smith Film Blog on Twitter. All of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thanks so much for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike's pre-show. That is EJ Gorilla. Don't forget to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to contact us, hit us up. Mike and Mike go to the movies at gmail.com. We will be back in 2 weeks with a great big question mark of a movie. The new Robert Rodriguez joint produced by James Cameron. Alita Battle Angel. Are you down for this, Mike?
Super down for some Uncanny Valley shit.
I've actually heard it's not bad, too, which I'm intrigued by. I think it could be cool. We'll see what happens. Hopefully, I'm hoping to get Vin on the podcast for that one, because that could be a really fun episode, because he's the anime guy that we know.
Yeah.
And you can check out our next Complete Works, where we're talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2014's Dying of the Light, directed by Paul Schrader, but taken away from him by the studio. Very controversial movie in his career, so we'll see how that goes.
It'll be fun.
It will be fun. And thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out. I don't need that in my life. I ain't Selena Kyle. I ain't no Vicky Bell. I was never into you even when you were Christian Bale. I'm more of a Keaton guy myself. Oh, I loved him as Beetlejuice. I'm just not into Gotham City guys. Well, yeah, we're flawed, but that's what makes us so relatable. I'm just not into
a bat wing can fly.
Rich boys with gadgets are not my type.
What is your type?
Kryptonian men are my kryptonite. I'm just not into Gotham City guys.
So what? You're not into me? I don't care. But like, listen up. You're clearly just confused. Gotham dudes are the best. We have deep, manly voices and insanely ripped pecs. We're athletic level hot and we're Oprah level rich. With George Clooney level charm and Val Kilmer lips. We work for our powers cause we're self-made men. We didn't just get them from the sun like an entitled alien. Go on one date with me and you'll change your mind.
Unsubscribe. I'm just not.